I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Charisma isn't necessarily about being attractive or articulate. It doesn't always involve charm or celebrity, although those qualities don't hurt. Instead, the ability to inspire a crowd involves a talent for telling a compelling narrative, a story that speaks to people's deeply felt anxieties, grievances, and hopes. That's what Molly Worthen writes about in her new book, Spellbound, How Charisma Shaped American History from the Puritans to Donald Trump. She says it's very human to attach ourselves to someone who can explain the complexities and difficulties of living a life. There's also an essential paradox at the root of this relationship, according to Worthen, the desire to feel free and important while giving up control to someone else. Molly Worthen is our guest today on The Connection to talk about how charismatic leaders have shaped religion and politics in the United States, and why the declining faith in institutions has given rise to a certain kind of charismatic leader. She's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's also a freelance journalist. And Molly Worthen, nice to have you today with us on The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, charismatic leaders have made their mark through history, for better or for worse. Is there something unique about the kind of charismatic leaders that have come out of America, or something unique about the Americans who have followed these charismatic leaders?
That's a great question, because in some ways, I do think we're talking about some pretty fundamental and universal human dynamics that show up across cultures and places. But at the same time, there is something peculiar and particular about the American story. I think there is, in American history, because of the particular mix of early immigrants who came disproportionately from backgrounds of religious dissent, anti-institutional backgrounds, you could say, as well as, of course, the history and legacy of the American Revolution. There is maybe a particular aversion to elite authority that ebbs and flows in American culture, a kind of suspicion of institutions that manifests in different ways at different times. And that combined, I think, with a particular kind of spiritual religious mix of American heritage does give, I think, charismatic leaders more purchase on American culture than perhaps they've had in other contexts.
You say, and you make it very clear, it's really about this relationship between a charismatic leader and their followers, or the followers who think this is a charismatic person. And you write, this peculiar way that our species has found to attach ourselves to authority, to organize the confusions and disappointments of life into a story that means something. So that a charismatic leader is charismatic because of the story they tell and how that resonates with people who follow them.
That's right. I was, I think, myself kind of confused about what charisma was when I started my research on this. It's a term that has a very old theological meaning that comes to us from the Bible, from the New Testament, you know, meaning a gift of grace, a supernatural power bestowed by God. But for the past 120 years or so, we have used in our colloquial speech a version of charisma that we owe really to the German sociologist Max Weber, who borrowed the word from that theological context and repurposed it to describe a kind of authority distinct from the authority that comes with military power or one's position in an institution or tradition. Authority that has to do with this relationship with followers, convincing followers one has a kind of supernatural power or mission. But I think in our colloquial use of the word charisma, we use it to mean all kinds of things. And often we do confuse it with charm, with the ability to work the room at a cocktail party. And I think I went into this project with that muddle in my mind. And I was surprised to find how many figures I was writing about over the course of American history were not particularly charming, or maybe it's better to say they were very polarizing. You know, you can find in the evidence just as many people having strong aversions to these leaders of mass movements, new religions, as being strongly attracted to them. And I think that that kind of polarizing effect of charismatic leaders also remains true in our own time.
They must, though, have a kind of intuitive understanding of people's, as you say, anxieties, their desires, their needs. They must understand something about either the culture or a group of people and what it is that they want, what they need.
That's exactly right. Charismatic leaders have a gift for understanding the particular anxieties and desires of their historical context. So I found in my research that in different periods of American history, different types of charismatic leaders, different charismatic styles, if you will, kind of rise and fall in cultural authority. And it has to do with perceiving that some significant swath of the American public is dissatisfied with the current cultural narratives on offer. They're looking for another way to explain their frustrations. I think as humans, you know, whether we consider ourselves religious or not, we inherently crave a way to connect our personal life to some big transcendent story, some frame in which it all means something. And that impulse, that desire hasn't waned, even as, you know, rates of church attendance and so forth have gone down. But I think what that looks like really hinges on the particularities of the cultural context. It's not the same kind of charismatic appeal that works today that, you know, worked in the 1600s.
I'm looking at the title of your book, Spellbound. I mean, is it a form of hypnosis? I mean, for people that really glom onto somebody and really believe that this is the person that's going to explain my life, that truly sees who I am, that's going to take me out of this morass. Is it a kind of hypnosis?
I think it's risky to talk about it as hypnosis. And certainly that is how, especially some of the crowd psychologists working in the late 19th and early 20th century, trying to make sense of the rise of a new kind of mass politics in Europe and America. They did speak about certain leaders casting a kind of hypnotic spell over their followers. When you look at the history of religious revivals, you see that kind of language among the skeptics who stand outside of this, and they're watching all of these crazy physical manifestations. You know, somehow this evangelist, this preacher seems to be causing people to lose control of their bodies, to go into trance, speak in tongues. And often they talk about it as hypnosis. I think when we do that, we give ourselves as the observer a shortcut, an excuse to not take seriously the perspective of the follower. To call something a story, to say that a leader is effective in building a charismatic movement because he or she is telling a story, is not to necessarily suggest that he or she is telling lies or is, you know, kind of handing a false view of the world to followers. And I think that, you know, that's associated with this language of hypnosis, or, you know, somehow there's trickery going on. I think this is the difference between charismatic leaders who are ultimately on the side of moral progress in our society.
Indeed.
And those who are not, right? Whether their story is based in reality, because a story can be about simply rearranging and revealing new facts that really are facts, and seeing a kind of potential in your followers that others haven't seen. Or it can be about confecting a kind of counter, a pseudo reality that is indeed divorced from empirical data. And that's dangerous. But charisma in and of itself is morally neutral. It can show up in both those manifestations.
It may be morally neutral, but is it emotionally neutral? And I ask that because when you know, I think people that feel when they're following someone or believing someone, it means so much to them, and it makes them feel, you know, a certain way that perhaps they're not alone in the world.
It's hard for me to imagine a charismatic relationship in which there isn't intense emotion on both the part of the leader and the follower. And, you know, emotion, I think that, you know, the more we learn from the research in psychology, you know, the more we have, I think, confirmation of what philosophers and theologians have been telling us for millennia, which is that humans are not rationalizing robots who move through the world, you know, calculating data. It's impossible to extricate emotion from our process of reasoning. And sometimes our emotional reactions can clarify as much as they can obscure. But you're right. I think that that component is always there. And it's part of what makes it so hard to understand a charismatic movement and the appeal of a leader if you are not pulled in by his story, because it doesn't submit to simple, you know, rationalistic quid pro quo, you know, reason. You can't see a kind of deal that makes sense to an outsider transpiring between the leader and followers. Something more, something ineffable is going on, and it eludes you if you're outside the story the leader's telling.
And you also have the power of the group. So a charismatic leader needs more than one follower. I mean, they need a group of followers, and you have the power of the group to say, I'm with you. We're part of this self-identified group of people who believe similar, if not the same thing.
That's right. If charisma resides not just in the person of the leader, but in the story, I think that helps us understand how charisma can travel, how it can inform the interactions that followers have with other people they're trying to recruit, how it can move through media. I first really started to grapple with this when I was learning about the early history of the Mormon Church and the role of the founder, Joseph Smith. He was someone who provoked very polarized reactions among people who met him. I mean, he was, to some people, tall, good looking. You know, one woman who met him said just shaking his hand made her, you know, feel the, you know, this zap of the Holy Spirit from the crown of her head to the soles of her feet. But another guy who met him around the same time, a skeptic, said he was just obviously a charlatan and he looked like a clown and he had these weird fat hands, and who would ever associate with this guy? And then I was also scratching my head trying to make sense of the thousands of converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the British Isles, who never laid eyes on Joseph Smith, but simply because of their encounters with Mormon missionaries, hearing about the Book of Mormon, reading it, learning about this story, they made the decision to shut down their lives in Britain, move across the Atlantic, resettle in this tiny town, Nauvoo, Illinois, on the banks of the Mississippi. So, you know, what is going on there? Clearly, there is a huge role for the followers.
Indeed.
As bearers of this story.
Well, Molly, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on our very first break here on The Connection, talking with Molly Worthen about charisma. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about charisma, charismatic leaders, and their followers. And again, Molly Worthen is our guest today on the show. She's just written a book called Spellbound, How Charisma Shaped American History from the Puritans to Donald Trump. Let me pick up on what you said right before the break about how charismatic leaders are often divisive or seen in very different ways. They have their supporters and they have their perhaps equally passionate detractors. Is there something that explains why one is seen one way and why seen the other way?
I think it has everything to do with your relationship to the story that the charismatic leader is telling. So, you know, I think about the famous example of someone who's often cited as charismatic, Bill Clinton, right?
Sure.
Like he makes you feel as if you're in the center, of the room, and he has this kind of mesmerizing effect. But I would wager that you're only in that room, you're only at that fundraising party or whatever it might be, if you have already bought into and seen yourself as part of the story he was telling as a politician. So there's something that happens upstream of your encounter with the charismatic leader, if you ever meet him or her in the flesh. And I think that is an encounter with the story. A good story has heroes and villains, it has tension, it has an arc. And therefore it's not a kind of big, bowl of jello into which everyone can just flow. It has some structure to it. It doesn't include everybody. So if you perceive yourself, correctly or incorrectly, to be excluded from the story this leader is telling, or you find yourself cast as a villain, I think you're going to find that person repulsive. So I'm pushing back, in a sense, on some of the social scientific literature that says, well, it's not at all about the content of the message. It's all about body language. Just don't think that that helps us understand, for example, the highly polarized reactions to the speech style of our current president, to Donald Trump's followers. His speeches are these authentic acts of truth-telling that cut through the performance that ordinary politicians engage in and really reveal the world as it is. And to his critics, they are meandering, baffling, stream of consciousness exercises and fabrication, right? But it's the same physical and auditory phenomenon provoking those very different reactions, I think, depending on how you see yourself in relationship to the story he's telling.
Well, let's talk. I was going to do this a little bit later in the hour, but let's talk about Donald Trump. And picking up on what you said there about how sort of hard it is, I think, for his critics to understand the people who follow him. You also say we live in this time of credulous cynicism that leaves people, quote, vulnerable to a guru who sneered at institutions that had failed them, affirmed their suffering, and promised new power, especially if the guru presented himself as the American paragon, the self-made man. And when I read that, I mean, there are other people you could ascribe to that description, but certainly Donald Trump fits that description. Is that who you were thinking of?
Absolutely. I think about our current era in reference to the long sweep of American history since European contact. And I think our appetite for anti-institutional narratives of tearing down and burning it all down, these are not without precedent in American history. Right. But in previous periods, when that impulse really came to the fore, the era that I call the era of the prophets in the colonial period, 1600s into the 1700s, an era I call the time of the agitators around the turn of the 20th century, a time of a great deal of labor unrest and racial unrest prior to the rise of kind of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Those were periods where we see, in some ways, echoes or omens of what we see now, I think. But traditions and institutions were a bit stronger. They had a greater hold on the loyalty and trust of the average American. And since the late 1950s, we have seen in the poll data a steady decline, becoming a real crash in American regard for all kinds of big institutions, across the board, right? From trust in mainstream media and universities to people's trust in Congress. And so I think that has created a kind of imbalanced social political ecosystem, and dangerously combined maybe with the internet age, with a time when we have this illusion of such autonomy and power in our ability to learn about the world, right? It seems like, you can get the true story of what's going on just by sitting on your couch and scrolling your phone and doing your own research. But I think that's a fake picture of what most of us are doing. We end up so quickly, thanks to the algorithms and the advertisers, siloed into a one little corner of self-reinforcing partial information. So we're quite helpless, I think, in the face of a narrative that, you know, confirms that so much is broken and offers this this appealing kind of messianic story of how it can be solved.
It's so interesting because certainly Trump offers that to his followers, the idea that there was a better time and he will take us back to that better time. But at the same time, we're also talking about a person, a businessman, a billionaire, an elite, a part of an elite group of billionaires. And oftentimes these movements are really opposed to the elite, but nonetheless, he's seen as a kind of figurehead for this. Someone with multiple bankruptcies, failed business ventures, cheating on his wives, accused, found guilty of sexual assault. We know about his language, about how he talks about women, his lies, his exaggerations, the company he keeps, most notably Jeffrey Epstein. And yet somehow all of that doesn't, for his critics, there's the evidence. You know, this is why this man is a charlatan. But for his followers, it doesn't seem to resonate with them in the same way at all.
I want to be careful and not lump all supporters for Donald Trump into one category. I spent a lot of time, interviewing and just having casual conversations with people who voted for Trump, and they did so for all kinds of reasons.
Sure.
And I think there's a large swath of his supporters who I would say are not particularly captive to his charisma, but rather, you know, they're conservative Christians who really vote on the abortion question, or, you know, conservative sexual ethics, and they correctly see him as the candidate who is the best choice for advancing that particular agenda. You know, you have the significant swing toward him, especially among demographics of color, and I think that's as much about the failure of the Democrats to offer a story as it is about appeal to Trump. You know, we heard plenty about inflation and people voting their pocketbooks.
Sure.
So I want to acknowledge that complexity, but I do think charisma does help us understand the kind of MAGA core. And it's a story. You know, I think Trump's rise is one that you need to begin charting long before his formal entry into politics. If you go back and read his interviews with tabloid reporters in New York City in the 1980s, he was already crafting a very skillful narrative about himself as this self-made man, right, really eliding the role of his father's fortune in elevating him at the start of his career, and one who is constantly facing at every turn some evil actor who's trying to screw him over. Right. And you know what? He's not going to fall for it. He's going to get revenge if they try anything. And you see him using language, you know, when he appears on Oprah Winfrey's show in the mid-1980s, you know, talking about the system is rigged, and not just he personally, but Americans in general are just getting ripped off. He talks that way frequently, and it presages the story that he really came to perfect, I think, in the context of his first presidential campaign. I also think it's important to remember that, you know, prior to 2015, 2016, what had most shaped most Americans' views of Donald Trump
TV.
Was not, yeah, exactly. The Apprentice.
The Apprentice and Celebrity
and,
Apprentice.
And the Apprentice is, if you watch, I mean, even just the opening credits, are just such a skillful, right? You're riding along in this helicopter with this bird's eye view of Trump's expanding empire and, you know, all of these skyscrapers with his brand name. And he alludes, you know, very sort of vaguely to having times where he had trouble, but then he came back more powerful than ever. And, you know, the producers of The Apprentice, they found his actual boardroom, you know, too frumpy for their purposes in the show, right? So they create, you know, one that's more stately, and he comes across as quite as a man of gravitas, right? In those scenes where he fires people, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't shout or yell. He just says in a very kind of even, low, serious voice, "You're fired," and that made a great impression. But you know, this is to me, this is one piece of the Trump phenomenon. I also I want to address, you know, his relationship to religion. I think this is something that's easy to misunderstand.
Well, let me hold off just one second, because I just want to do a couple little follow-ups before we get to that. And picking up on something you said earlier, obviously his TV shows helped to catapult him. Also, the rise of social media, his use of social media, Twitter, and now Truth Social, his ability to kind of soundbite things in a way that seems to resonate with his followers.
Absolutely. And even just the nature of that media and the feeling that his followers have of a kind of direct access to, you know, his off-the-cuff thoughts at 3 a.m, it is this, I think, illusion, maybe not entirely an illusion, but it is this dose of apparent authenticity in an era when, you know, I think people feel that their access to the views and behavior of those in power is mediated and mysterious in so many ways. Now, you know, I think it's a kind of false simplification that one gets by thinking you have access to the heart of power and the thoughts, you know, simply through the president's Truth Social postings. But it's very effective.
Indeed, a kind of fake authenticity, which is such an interesting thing. You quote Ivana Trump. I don't know if they were married at the time or they were divorced at the time in this book. And I just think it's very insightful what she says. She says he's the people's billionaire. You have no idea. Middle class Americans adore Donald. I don't know why. They shouldn't. They should resent him. He's young and wealthy and he flaunts it. But they do. at least, you know, many of his followers do. It's such an interesting kind of dichotomy there.
I suppose, you know, there's a long history of that conundrum in American politics, and it's not present only on the right. I mean, I do remember, especially during George W. Bush's campaign and presidency, Democrats remarking, well, you know, how can he use this populist rhetoric? You know, he's a product of the Ivy League and, you know, one of the great, aristocratic families in America, but it was very effective. But I think you can go back and make some of the same observations about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and, you know, talk about a blue blood, right?
Sure.
But he when he needed to, you know, when especially, and this is what I call the era of the agitators, when he was facing a serious political challenge on his left flank in the form of the Louisiana populist Huey Long, he could absolutely turn up the kind of populist demagoguery, much to the alarm of his technocrat brain trust advisors. And, you know, that same dissonance between his wealthy elite standing and his message struck FDR's critics, but it didn't prevent him from persuading, you know, plenty of Americans that he was on their side and he saw the same injustices that they did. So that is a longstanding pattern that's not new with Trump.
Let me quote something that you read in the book, Molly. You write, if the history of charismatic leaders teaches us anything, it's that observers who try to understand a leader's relationship with his followers make a mistake if they focus on the cogency of his arguments, the soundness of his factual claims, or the attractiveness of his personality. I thought that was really insightful. Why doesn't that matter? And what should be focused on instead?
It's difficult. I don't know that I want to say it doesn't matter at all. I mean, I do think that truth does matter. We don't live in some sort of postmodern miasma. But I think that, you know, what humans respond to is so much more at once both complicated and simpler than, you know, say the bullet points on a party's website. Humans, you know, our world is so complicated and we are constantly looking for mental shortcuts. None of us could function if we had to pause and, you know, empirically seek evidence for, you know, every assumption on which we reason and kind of move through the day. So we're constantly, you know, outsourcing our own reasoning to the extent that we are any good at it to figures of authority and to the kind of momentum of a narrative storyline. It's not enough to present people with a series of true observations about the world. They won't hang together.
Right.
They won't have emotional effect if they aren't knit into a plot line. And so, I think that is really the difference between a successful political or religious movement and one that fails to garner any followers. Does it make claims about the world that are interesting, that begin to answer questions people have? And does it present those claims in the momentous form of a story that's going somewhere and that invites me into it, that tells me as a potential follower, I have a role to play?
This might be a more psychological question, but do you think demagogues or do you think charismatic leaders have to be wary of adoration of their followers, of people who like them, who want to be like them, that the sort of risk of demagoguery is there for even the most well-intentioned, good, if I can say, good charismatic leader?
Yes, because the followers have power.
Right.
They're not. It's a dialectic, and this is something that makes Max Weber saw, 120 years ago. That charisma is not. It's not a thing that the leader possesses. It's a relationship. I think one thing that distinguishes morally responsible, ultimately more successful, I think, charismatic leaders from those whose movements tend to burn out or that veer off into atrocities of various kinds, is whether that leader sees exactly the hazard you're pointing to and sees therefore the importance of checks and balances and embedding his or her personal authority into the structure of an institution and telling followers, I am inviting you into this movement, but I am not the sole gatekeeper to truth. I am here to connect you with this, broader community, this set of traditions, these institutions that are bigger than any one person. That's a rare leader who does that, though. I think naturally it's the human temptation to hang on to one's personal authority over other people.
Well, that's a perfect setup for our clip from Monty Python, which we will do after this very short break. And that's Molly Worthen, our guest today on The Connection. She's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's also a freelance journalist. She's written a couple of books, and the one we're talking about is her new one. It is titled Spellbound: How Charisma Shaped American History from the Puritans to Donald Trump. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco. And again, Molly Worthen is our guest today on the show. She is a historian, and she's got a new book called Spellbound: How Charisma Shaped American History from the Puritans to Donald Trump. And we've been talking about how some people have this ability to inspire or sometimes inflame, to move crowds of people. Charisma is often in the eye or the ear of the beholders. Followers who find meaning in a leader's message, whether they are a charlatan or a sage. And we were talking about leaders and followers. And Molly, I have to say, as I was reading your book, I kept thinking of this Monty Python clip. So that's the reason we're going to play it. And this is a clip from Life of Brian, 1979, which does satirize religion and politics and many other things. Brian is Brian Cohen. He's played by Graham Chapman, who is mistaken for the Messiah. He is chased by adoring crowds who want to hear his words of wisdom. Now, in this scene, Brian is home with his mother, who's played by Terry Jones, while his followers fill the streets below. His mother tells the crowds to go away. Her son is not the Messiah, she says. He's just a naughty boy. Brian appears at the window to tell his followers to think for themselves.
I've got one or two things to say.
Tell us!
You've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals.
Yes!
work it out for yourself.
Yes, we've got to work it out for ourselves.
Exactly.
And his mother drags him away from the window. I wanted to play that. First of all, I think it just touches on so many interesting things, especially about what you were saying about charisma, about leaders and followers, and about this kind of essential paradox that's at the root of this relationship, that on the one hand, you know, we are empowering someone else to speak for us. So that creates a kind of dependence on them. And at the same time, we feel free because we have given over this power to that other person. Can you speak to that?
I think, you know, life is overwhelming. And so much of what happens to us doesn't make any sense, doesn't seem fair. And we're constantly looking for ways to grapple with that and want, on the one hand, a degree of agency, a sense that we do have some say in what happens to us. But that responsibility is a bit terrifying, and we shrink back from totally claiming it. And so we want to have our cake and eat it too, I suppose, as free modern individuals. I love that clip you played also because I think it captures what I guess is sort of the driving illusion of the modern West that is especially prominent in the stories Americans tell themselves, which is that we are totally free, autonomous individuals. And, you know, the secret to fulfillment is to discover that, you know, your true self, to use the language that became so popular in the 1960s.
Sure.
You know, freedom means self-actualization. You can almost be your own messiah. It's kind of what Brian is telling his followers there. And that is, I think, the guiding myth of America. And it's a lie. I mean, every story we get about our own identity, I mean, it's one that we develop in concert with our relationship to communities, our, you know, traditions. We don't exist in some kind of vacuum. You know, you are not born with this like flame of authentic self that just needs to grow brighter, right, over the course of your life. You know, it has to feed on the oxygen of culture and history and institutions. And I think in American culture, we've become severed to an extreme degree, especially in the 21st century, from, you know, the ways in which, you know, the human race has understood roles and duties and sources of identity over the history of our species. And so we are fed this story by the culture that, you know, all you need is to get a few self-help books.
Sure.
Or, you know, find the right influencers on social media and you can find your own path to happiness. And when it doesn't work out, I think that leaves us even more vulnerable to people who then can swoop in and say they have all the answers.
Or pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I mean, the idea of the self-made man, or now, of course, woman as well. The idea that if you do it, you can do it yourself and you don't really need anybody else.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, this fear of dependence and fear of being, you know, woven together, you know, in a set of roles and obligations to other people. It's scary. It's not something that the language of kind of modern secular liberalism is really equipped for, but it's the reality of the human condition.
Well, in fact, you're right. The humans are fundamentally religious. We want to impose order on the chaos of existence and worship something that gives us meaning. I mean, when you use the word religious, are you saying that we're, you know, not necessarily going to synagogue or church or mosque, but we have this desire, this need perhaps, to understand, of a greater understanding of all the mysteries and complexities of what it is to live a life on earth?
Exactly. We want it all to amount to something greater than our immediate material existence. So many of our decisions, I think, are driven by things that are not explicable in terms of our immediate material needs. I mean, this is one reason why I'm so interested in studying, you know, human history because sure. because why we do what we do is so mysterious. It's also true, though, that, you know, if you look at the poll data, while and there have been some exceptions recently that are really interesting, you know, some demographics moving back to organized religion, but in general, Westerners and Americans' affiliation with traditional religious institutions has been going down. But at the same time, you know, something like 87% of Americans will tell pollsters that they believe in at least one, you know, what you could maybe broadly call New Age belief, like karma or reincarnation. You know, the majority of Americans pray regularly. We have this huge swath of people who call themselves spiritual but not religious, you know, mm-hmm. so much language about, you know, manifesting, you know, the future that I want, right? This sense, like, if I can just align myself with, you know, the universe in a particular way, everything will work out. That is an old and really potent tradition in American spirituality that seems to me to be just as vibrant now as it ever was. And it's actually one that Donald Trump has been plugged into his whole life. I mean, he grew up going to Norman Vincent Peale's church in New York City. Norman Vincent Peale, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, one of the grandfathers of the American Christian prosperity gospel tradition, which has many forms, but it's, you know, it's premised on this idea that God or, you know, the divine powers reward people who align themselves with the universe, who pray the right things, and you can kind of wish or pray the reality you want into existence. That basic orientation, I mean, has Christian forms and plenty of non-Christian forms. And Trump was steeped in it as a young man. And if you look at his early allies in the conservative Christian world, they too often have a connection to the kind of Christian prosperity gospel. His spiritual advisor, Paulo White Cain, who he's known, I mean, I think since 2002, so long before he had strategic need for evangelical advice for political reasons, he found a natural kinship with this stream of American Christianity. So while, you know, he's quite far from being an Orthodox Christian in so many regards, he does, you know, have a kind of native spiritual tradition that resonates with so many Americans and is absolutely connected to that kind of myth-making you referred to, a sort of spiritual pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
Well, it's interesting to think of prosperity, the prosperity gospel, and capitalism. I mean, it seems that they have much in common.
I guess capitalism, you know, it's a way of describing economic relations that can mean a range of things, and certainly has plenty of room for, you know, sober-minded recommendations of all kinds of government regulation, right? But then there is a kind of mythological version of what capitalism is and what it means in the American story. And that, you know, this is a capitalistic country that is in radical ways different from, you know, the feudal past of the old world. And capitalism gets equated with this particular kind of individual freedom. But I, you know, I think that way in which the words get collapsed, it really creates more confusion than it clarifies. And then, you know, you have political polarization where different sides kind of claim words, right? I mean, you know, the way in which the American right has claimed the, you know, the word freedom and made it this sort of conservative shibboleth, I think has been, or patriotism, right? Has been a huge blow to the left. There's no reason why those terms should be partisan, but they have become so.
Thinking about these charismatic leaders and perhaps the ones who are a little more demagogic, do they burn themselves out? Do they go too far? Do followers lose interest? Or do they just keep on going? I mean, I realize, and we're talking about a lot of different kinds of people, but as you see it.
That's a great question. I think it's important to remember that charisma is this claim on authority that is distinct from authority you get through having a role in an institution or access to a monopoly of force, military power. And those are historically more reliable means of controlling your fellow man. So in a sense, making a charismatic claim, you know, saying I am anointed in a special way by the divine, or I am your best option because, you know, the elites have been lying to you. That's a risky move. And historically, charisma has often been, you know, the last ditch option for the weak. For, you know, people who are squeezed out of more reliable sources of power historically, whether it's because they have a, you know, a dissenting political position, or women, or people of color, what have you. So in that sense, you know, there's a precariousness to most charismatic movements, and one that, you know, spells doom pretty rapidly if they don't fuse their, you know, that charismatic authority that is so, you know, volatile. It really depends on followers maintaining a certain faith in this individual. If that doesn't get fused sure. with institution building, I think it does flame out. If the individual dies or, you know, is incapacitated in some way, it's hard for the movement to sustain itself. In cases where it does, I mean, the Mormons are a good example of this. It's because the leader and some crucial, you know, colleagues help build an institution that captures some of that charismatic power so that it can outlast the life of the individual.
I read that you grew up in a secular family and you have become religious. You're now, as I understand, an evangelical Christian. What does that give you that you didn't have?
That's interesting. I became a Christian after writing about three quarters of this book about charisma. And, you know, in a sense, I suppose I've always believed that humans are in this fundamental way seeking a source of transcendent meaning. That's the story I'm telling in this book, and it, you know, manifests in various forms, Christian and non-Christian. And so I suppose my own conversion, which, mm-hmm. you know, came about when I was sort of caught by surprise and evangelized by a pastor and compelled to really look at the evidence for the claims that Christians make about the history of the of Jesus and the resurrection in a new way. It means that the grand theory, I suppose, I've always had about humans, that this is what we're seeking. It applies to me personally, and there's no reason it shouldn't. As I'm trained as a historian operating in a secular sphere, so I hope that the narrative I tell is one that, you know, can make sense to students of history regardless of their own metaphysics. But I do argue in the book, and I guess this grows out of my own respect for the human hunger for encounters with the supernatural, that charisma in that New Testament sense, that sense of, you know, the fire of God, these manifestations of the supernatural that result in inexplicable behavior and, you know, reports of healings and prophecies and speaking in tongues, the kind of spiritual experience that I think mainstream more secular Americans or simply, you know, Americans who see themselves as more rational in their practice of religion look askance at, that it's not fundamentally a different thing from our close emotional relationships to certain political leaders, even though we might describe one as secular and one as religious. Instead, I see them as kind of a continuum that describe the same human hunger for connection with the transcendent and the desire to elevate some source of ultimate concern above ourselves and orient our lives toward that. And I hope in making that argument that I can encourage both secular and religious people to see one another as more alike than we are different.
Well, that is a worthy cause, and I think you certainly are beginning to crack that egg, so to speak. Molly Worthen, thank you very much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, her book is titled Spellbound: How Charisma Shaped American History from the Puritans to Donald Trump. And again, she's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's also a freelance journalist. Thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.